watchfully before the Federal 17,000, awaiting the answer to his prayers. Then it came. As he fell back through Winchester, spies reported the enemy regiments scattered. A quick slash at the head might confuse the whole column into exposing one or two of its segments to destruction. When he called a meeting of his officers to plan the attack, however, he learned that his wagon train was already miles to the south. Without food or reserve ammunition, his hungry men would have to continue their retreat. Jackson was furious, somehow placing the blame on the assembly of officers. "That is the last council of war I will ever hold," he vowed. And it was. The retreat continued through Kernstown, 4 miles to the south, then another 40 miles up the valley pike, past the slopes of the Massanuttons. All through the retreat Jackson watched and prayed, but for 10 days Providence did not smile on him again. Then, suddenly, it did. On Friday the 21st, his cavalry commander reported the enemy pulling back. One division had turned off eastward toward Manassas, and the other was retiring north toward Winchester. Next morning Jackson had his infantry on the road. 25 miles they marched that day, and 15 the next, retracing their steps to reach Kernstown at 2 p.m. Sunday, and find the horse artillery already skirmishing with what the cavalry commander said was the Federal rear guard. 4 regiments left to protect the tail of the column slogging north for Harper's Ferry. Jackson's blue eyes lighted. Here was the chance to inflict that terrible wound. Certain considerations urged postponement. He had made no detailed personal reconnaissance. His ranks were thinned by 1,500 stragglers he had left along the pike in the past 2 days. Last but not least, this was the Lord's Day. Jackson would not even write a letter on a Sunday, or post one that would be in transit then, fearing that Providence might punish the profanation. These were all set aside, however, when weighed against the chances for success. There must be no delay. The sun was already down the sky. Without taking time to brief his commanders, he put his men into attack formation, the Stonewall Brigade in the center, and threw them forward. This was his first full-scale battle on his own, and he intended to make the victory sudden and complete. It was sudden enough, but it was so far from complete that it was not even a victory. It was a repulse, and a bloody one at that. When the men in gray went forward, the Federals absorbed the shock and held their ground, returning the fire. Quickly it swelled to crescendo as Jackson sent in his reserves. Presently, to his amazement, men began to stumble out of the roar and flash of battle, making for the rear. He rode forward to block the way. "Where are you going, man?" he shouted at one retreater. The soldier explained that he had fired all his cartridges. "Then go back and give them the bayonet," Jackson cried. But the man ran on unheeding, one among many. Even the Stonewall Brigade, with its hard core of veterans who had stood fast on Henry Hill, was wavering. Just as it was about to break, its commander, Brigadier General Richard Garnett, gave the order to retreat. Amazed at what appeared to be his army's disintegration, Jackson seized a drummer boy by the shoulder and dragged him onto a knoll, shouting as he held him, "Beat the rally!" The roll of the drum did nothing to slow the rout. Jackson fell back in the demoralized wake of his soldiers. Fortunately for him, the Federals did not pursue. The Battle of Kernstown, such as it was over. Suffering 700 casualties to the enemy's 590, Jackson's men had done a better job than Jackson himself when it came to estimating Federal strength. That was no mere rear guard they had charged, but a whole 9,000-man division. When he learned that he had thus unknowingly reversed the dictum that the attacker must outnumber the defender 3-1, Jackson did not allow it to temper the sternness of his discipline. Garnett had retreated without orders. Peremptorily, Jackson relieved him of command and put him in arrest to await court-martial for neglect of duty. It did not matter that he had graduated from West Point the year before Jackson came there as a plebe, that he was a member of the proud Tidewater family which had given the Confederacy the first general officer lost in battle, or that his men loved him and resented the harshness that took him from them. It did not even matter that his brigade might have been cut to pieces if he had held it there, outnumbered, outflanked, and out of ammunition, while he went fumbling along the chain of command in search of permission to withdraw. What mattered was that the next officer who found himself in a tight spot would stay there, awaiting higher sanction, before ordering a retreat. As for accepting any personal blame for this loss of nearly one-fourth of his little army because of ragged marching, faulty reconnaissance, poor intelligence, ill-prepared assault, or disorganized retreat, Jackson could not see it. In fact, he did not seem to understand that he had been defeated. "The Yankees don't seem willing to quit Winchester, General," a young cavalryman said in bivouac that night. Jackson replied, "Winchester is a very pleasant place to stay in, sir." The trooper attempted a further pleasantry. "It was reported that they were retreating, but I guess they were retreating after us." Jackson, who had a limited sense of humor, kept looking into the campfire. "I think I may say I am satisfied, sir," he said. How far he saw into the future as he said this would remain a question to be pondered down the years, but most likely old Blue Light would have been still more satisfied if he had known the reaction his repulse was producing that night in the enemy camp, even as he warmed his hands at the bivouac fire and refused to admit that what he had suffered was a defeat. His adversary, while congratulating himself on a hard-fought victory, could not believe that Jackson would have dared to attack without expecting reinforcements. Orders went out recalling to the valley the division that had left for Manassas 2 days ago, which meant, in effect, a loss of 8,000 men for McClellan, who was charged with leaving a covering force to protect the junction when the balance of his army sailed. Equally important, if not more so, was the effect on Lincoln, who quarter-faced at the news of the battle, victory or no, and found himself looking once more down the muzzle of the Shenandoah shotgun. The Kernstown explosion seemed to prove that it was loaded. Whatever it was for Lincoln, news of the battle, coupled with the recall of the division headed eastward, was a thorn in McClellan's side, a hurt which in time might fester and hurt worse. As such, however, it was no sharper than the thorn that stuck him 1 week later on the eve of his own departure for Fort Monroe. He had in his army, in Sumner's corps, a division commanded by Lewis Blenker, a man of considerable flamboyance. Blenker was a soldier of fortune, a German, and his men were known as Germans too, this being the current generic term for immigrants of all origins except Ireland. But the fact was they were almost everything: Algerians, Cossacks, Sepoys, Turks, Croats, Swiss, French Foreign Legionnaires, and a Garibaldi regiment with a Hungarian colonel, one Dutassi, who had begun his career as a circus rider and was to end it as an inmate of Sing Sing. Blenker affected a red-lined cape and a headquarters tent made of double folds of bluish material, restful to the eye, where the shout, "Ordinance numero eins," was the signal for the serving of champagne. His soldiers got lager beer, and there was a prevailing aroma of sauerkraut around the company messes. All this, the glitter of fire-gilt buttons, the babble of polyglot commands, and the smell of German cooking, was reminiscent of one of Fremont's old Trans-Mississippi outfits. And the fact was, Fremont was doing all he could to get hold of the division even now. The Pathfinder was back on the road to glory, though it led now not through Missouri or down the winding course of the Mississippi, but along the western border of Virginia and across the rolling peaks of the Alleghenies. Under pressure from the Jacobins, who had never stopped protesting their favorite's dismissal and urging that he be returned to duty, Lincoln, in the same war order which removed McClellan from overall command, plucked Fremont out of retirement and gave him what was called the Mountain Department, specially created for this purpose, along with 25,000 men. Having learned that the former explorer was a poor administrator, he now presented him with this chance to prove himself a fighter. Fremont at once came up with a plan he knew would delight the president. Give him 10,000 additional soldiers, he said, and he would capture Knoxville. What was more, he had a particular 10,000 in mind, Blenker's Germans. Lincoln pricked up his ears at this offer to accomplish one of his pet war aims, then went down to Alexandria to see if McClellan was willing to give up the division. Far from willing, McClellan urged the commander-in-chief not to weaken the Army of the Potomac at the moment when it was half embarked on its trip to the gates of Richmond. Lincoln agreed, on second thought, that it would not do, and returned to Washington. Once more he had gotten nowhere with McClellan face to face. Within the week, however, on the final day of March, the general received a presidential note. "This morning I felt constrained to order Blenker's division to Fremont, and I write this to assure you that I did so with great pain, understanding that you would wish it otherwise. If you could know the full pressure of the case, I am confident that you would justify it, even beyond a mere acknowledgment that the commander-in-chief may order what he pleases. Yours very truly, A. Lincoln." The closing phrase had a Stantonian ring, administering a backhand cut that stung. But what alarmed McClellan most was the undeniable evidence that under political pressure, the nation's leader would swerve into paths which he knew were militarily unwise. How much grief this might hold for the army remained to be seen. For the present, McClellan could only repeat what he had written to his wife 3 weeks ago when he learned of War Order 3. "The rascals are after me again. I've been foolish enough to hope that when I went into the field they would give me some rest, but it seems otherwise. Perhaps I should have expected it. If I can get out of this scrape, you will never catch me in the power of such a set again." Now as then, however, he was too busy to protest. Just before embarking next afternoon, All Fool's Day, he sent Lincoln a roster of the troops he was leaving for the protection of the capital. His generals had advised a covering force of 40,000. McClellan listed 77,456 thus: 10,859 at Manassas, 7,780 at Warrenton, 35,476 in the Shenandoah Valley, 1,350 along the lower Potomac, and 22,000 around Washington proper. This done, he went aboard a steamer, worked in his cabin on last-minute paperwork details till after midnight, then set out for Fort Monroe. McDowell's corps and what was left of Sumner's were to come along behind within the week. Looking back on the journey after landing at Old Point Comfort, he informed his wife, "I did not feel safe until I could see Alexandria behind us." What was called for now, he saw, was action. He kept busy all that day and the next. "The great battle," he wrote his wife, "will be, I think, near Richmond, as I have always hoped and thought. I see my way very clearly, and with my trains once ready, will move rapidly." The following morning, April 4th, he put two columns in motion for Yorktown, where the Confederate left was anchored on York River, behind fortifications whose reduction his corps commanders had said would depend on naval cooperation. All went well on the approach march. The day was clear, the sky bright blue, the trees new green and shiny. Near sundown, exultant, he wired Stanton, "I expect to fight tomorrow." His spirits were much improved at the prospect, and also perhaps from having observed what he called a wonderfully cool performance by three of his soldiers that afternoon. The trio of foragers had chased a sheep within range of the rebel entrenchments, where, ignoring the fire of sharpshooters, but not the fact that they were being watched by McClellan and their comrades while they demonstrated their contempt for the enemy's marksmanship, they calmly killed and skinned the animal before heading back for their own lines. The Confederates then brought a 12-pounder to bear, scoring a near miss. Undaunted, the soldiers halted, picked up the shot, and lugged it along, still warm, for presentation to Little Mac. "I never saw so cool and gallant a set of men," he declared, seeing in this bright cameo of action a reflection of the spirit of his whole army. "They did not seem to know what fear is." This gap in their education was about to be filled, however. Part 2. Chapter 4. War Means Fighting. Earl Van Dorn came west with great expectations. He knew what opportunities awaited a bold commander there, and his professional boldness had been tested and applauded. Approaching his prime at 41, He was dark-skinned and thin-faced, with a shaggy mustache, an imperial, and a quick, decisive manner. Buck, his fellow Confederates called him. Except for his size, he was 5 feet 5, 2 inches taller than Napoleon. He was, in fact, the very Beau Sabreur of Southern fable, the Bayard Lochinvar of maiden dreams. Not that his distinction was based solely on his looks. He was a man of action, too, one who knew how to grasp the nettle, danger, and had done so many times. Appointed to West Point by his great-uncle, Andrew Jackson, he had gone on to collect 2 brevets and 5 wounds as a lieutenant in the Mexican War, and in skirmishes with Comanches on the warpath. In the end, he had been rewarded with a captaincy in Sidney Johnston's 2nd Cavalry, adding his own particular glitter to that spangled company. He was a Mississippian, which simplified his decision when the South seceded. For him, there was little or none of the agony of the border state professionals. Furthermore, as it did for others blessed or cursed with an ache for adventure, the conflict promised deferment of middle age and boredom. He came home and was made a brigadier, second only to Jefferson Davis in command of Mississippi troops, and then received the command itself, with the rank of major general, when Davis left for Montgomery. This was much, but not enough. Wanting action even more than rank and what he called immortal renown more than either, Van Dorn resigned to accept a colonel's commission in the Confederate Army and assignment to service in Texas. Here he found at least a part of what he was seeking. At Galveston, he assembled a scratch brigade of volunteers and captured 3 Federal steamships in the harbor, including the famous Star of the West, which had been fired on back in January for attempting relief of Sumter, then marched on Indianola, where he forced the surrender of the only body of U.S. regulars in the state. For these exploits, characterized by incisiveness and daring, he was tendered a banquet and ball in San Antonio, and had his praises sung in all the Southern papers, though perhaps the finest compliment paid him was by a northern editor who put a price of $5,000 on his head, this being nearly twice the standing offer for the head of Beauregard. In acknowledgment of his services and fame, the government gave him a double promotion and summoned him to Richmond. He was a major general again, this time in command of all the cavalry in Virginia. Even this did not seem commensurate with his abilities, however. Presently, when Davis was in need of a commander for what was to be called Trans-Mississippi Department No. 2, he had to look no farther than his fellow Mississippian Earl Van Dorn, right there at hand. It was another case, apparently, of history attending to her own. Within 9 days of his mid-January assignment to the West, despite the fact that he was convalescing from a bad fall suffered while attempting a risky ditch jump, he was an excellent horseman. His aide, required by custom to try it too, was injured even worse. Van Dorn established headquarters at Pocahontas, Arkansas, and began a first-hand estimate of the situation. This in itself was quite a task, since the command included all of Missouri and Arkansas, Indian Territory, and Louisiana down to the Red River. But one thing he had determined at the outset. He would go forward, north along the line of the Mississippi, taking cities and whipping Yankee armies as he went. In short, as Van Dorn saw it, the campaign was to be a sort of grand reversal of Fremont's proposed descent of the Big River. On the day of his appointment, already packing for the long ride west from Richmond, he had written his wife, "I must have St. Louis, then huzzah." So much he intended, but first he knew he must concentrate his scattered troops for striking. Ben McCulloch's army of 8,000 was camped in the Boston Mountains, south of Fayetteville, the position it had taken after the victory over Lyon at Wilson's Creek. Off in the territory, moving to join him, was a band of about 2,000 pro-Confederate Indians, Creeks and Seminoles, Cherokees, Chickasaws, and Choctaws, won over by the persuasions of the lawyer-poet, scholar-duelist, orator-soldier Albert Pike, who led them. Sterling Price's 7,000 Missourians, under pressure from a superior federal army after their late fall and early winter successes in their home state, had fallen back to a position near the scene of their August triumph. Combined, these three totaled something under half the striking force the new commander had envisioned. But 17,000 should be enough to crush the Federals threatening Springfield, after which would come St. Louis, then huzzah! Van Dorn planned to unite at Ironton, fight, and then swing north, augmented by the enthusiasts a victory would bring trooping to the colors. Deep in the bleak western woods, he hailed his army with Napoleonic phrases. "Soldiers, behold your leader. He comes to show you the way to glory and immortal renown. Awake, young men of Arkansas, and arm. Beautiful maidens of Louisiana, smile not on the craven youth who may linger by your hearth when the rude blast of war is sounding in your ears. Texas chivalry to arms." This might have brought in volunteers, a host bristling with bayonets much as the address itself bristled with exclamation points, though as events turned out there was no time for knowing. By now it was late February, and the pressure of the 12,000-man Northern Army against Springfield was too great. Price gave way, retreating while his rear guard skirmished to delay the Federals, first across the Arkansas line, then down through Fayetteville, until presently he was with McCulloch in the Boston Mountains, the southernmost reach of the Ozarks. By that time, Pike had come up, too. Van Dorn's command was concentrated. Not where he had wanted it, however, and not so much by his own efforts as by the enemy's. Then, too, except in the actual heat of battle, Price and McCulloch had never really got along, and they did no better now. Both appealed to their leader at Pocahontas to come and resolve their differences in person. Van Dorn was more than willing. In 4 days, after sending word for them to stand firm and prepare to attack, he rode 200 horseback miles through the wintry wilds of Arkansas. Arriving March 3rd, he was given a salute of 40 guns, as befitted his rank, and that night orders went out for the men to prepare 3 days' cooked rations and gird themselves for a forced march, with combat at its end. The Federals, widely separated in pursuit of Price, were about to be destroyed in detail. Early next morning, the Southerners set out, 17,000 men and 60 guns moving north to retake what had been lost by retrograde. As conglomerate, as motley an army as the sun ever shone on, east or west, though as a matter of fact the sun was not shining now. Snow fell out of an overcast sky, and the wind whipped the underbrush and keened in the branches of the winter trees. Price's Missourians led the way, marching homeward again, proud of the campaign they had staged and proud, too, of their 290-pound ex-governor commander, who could be at once so genial and majestic. McCulloch, the dead-shot former ranger, wearing a dove-gray corduroy jacket, sky-blue trousers, Wellington boots, and a highly polished Maynard rifle slung across one shoulder, rode among his Texans and Arkansans. Texicans and Rackensackers, they were called. Hard-bitten men accustomed to life in the open, who boasted that they would storm hell itself if McCulloch gave the order. Off on the flank, in a long thin file, the Five Nations Indians followed their leader Albert Pike, a big man bearded like Santa Claus, except that the beard was not white but a vigorous gray. He rode in a carriage and was dressed in Sioux regalia, buckskin shirt, fringed leggings, and beaded moccasins, while his braves, harking back to their warpath days, wore feathers stuck in their hats and scalping knives in their waistbands, some marching with a musket in one hand and a tomahawk in the other. The knives were for more than show. They intended to use them, having promised their squaws the accustomed trophies of battle. Van Dorn also rode horse-drawn. He rode, in fact, supine in an ambulance, still feeling the effects of the ditch jump back in Virginia, and down as well with chills and fever as a result of swimming his mare across an icy river 2 days ago, in his haste to join the army and get it moving. The mayor was hitched alongside now, available in emergencies, and Price rode alongside too, identifying passing units and ready to relay orders when the time came. The new commander was nothing if not a man of action, bold and forward, sick or well, and the troops he led had caught something of his spirit. Trudging up the road down which they had retreated just the week before, they were in a high good humor, despite the norther blowing wet snow in their faces. The previous afternoon, some dozen miles away on a grassy knoll near Cross Hollows, Arkansas, where his headquarters tent was pitched, the commander of the army that had just cleared southwest Missouri of organized Confederates sat writing a letter home. At 57, having put on weight, he found that long hours in the saddle wearied him now a good deal more than they had done 15 years before, when he had abandoned army life for civil engineering. A dish-faced man with a tall forehead and thinning, wavy hair, hazel eyes, and a wide, slack-lipped mouth, he drew solace from such periods of relaxation as this, sitting in full uniform, polished boots, epaulets, and spurs, enjoying the sounds of camp life in the background and the singing of the birds, while he inscribed to the wife of his bosom letters which he signed, rather ponderously, "Yours, Samuel R. Curtis." A West Pointer, like the opponent he did not yet know he was facing, he had commanded an Ohio regiment in the Mexican War, had been chief engineer for the city of St. Louis, and had served for the past 3 years as Republican congressman from Iowa. Of all his accomplishments, however, he was proudest of the current one, performed as a brigadier general of volunteers. Chasing the rebels out of Missouri might not sound like much compared to Grant's recent unconditional capture of 2 forts and 1 whole army in Tennessee, but Curtis felt that it was a substantial achievement. He was saying so in the letter, when his writing was interrupted by the sudden far-off rumble of cannon. It came from the south, and he counted 40 well-spaced booms, the salute for a major general. This gave him pause, and with the pause came doubts. His 4 divisions were rather scattered, 2 of them 12 miles in his rear and 2 thrown forward under Franz Siegel, the immigrant mathematics instructor who had shown a talent for retreat at Wilson's Creek. Curtis was a cautious, or at any rate a highly methodical person. He liked to allow for contingencies, an engineer's margin for stress and strain, and he could never feel comfortable until he knew he had done so. Back in the fall, inspecting Fremont's pinwheel dispositions, he had reported that the Pathfinder lacked the intelligence, the experience, and the sagacity necessary to his command. Placing as he did the highest value on all 3 of these qualities, especially the last, which he himself personified, that was about the worst he could say of a man. Accordingly, when Fremont was removed and Curtis was given the task of driving the rebels out of Missouri, which Fremont had considered more or less incidental to the grand design, he went about it differently. He gave it his full attention, and it went well. Too well, in fact, or anyhow too easy. Price fell back and the Federals followed through a deserted region, cabins empty though food was still bubbling in pots on ranges, laundry soaking in lukewarm sudsy water, clocks ticking ominously on mantels, and now this, 40 booms from across the wintry landscape, signifying for all to hear that an overall enemy chieftain had arrived. Curtis thought perhaps he had better consolidate to meet developments that threatened stress and strain. Next day his fears were reinforced and indeed confirmed when scouts, including young Wild Bill Hickok, addicted to gaudy shirts and a mustache whose ends could be knotted behind his head, came riding in with reports that the Confederates were marching north in strength. Convinced and alarmed, Curtis sent word for Siegel to exercise his talent by falling back on Sugar Creek, up near the Missouri line, where he himself would be waiting with the other 2 divisions. There they would combine and, in turn, await the enemy. It was a good defensive position, with a boggy stream across the front and a high ridge to protect the rear, as both men knew from having come through it the week before in pursuit of Price. Also, if they hurried, there would be time to fortify. Curtis fell back as planned and presently received word that Siegel was coming, skirmishing as he came. Near sundown, March 6th, he got there with the grayback cavalry close behind him, hacking at his rear. He strode into the commander's tent, a small, quick-gestured, red-haired man in gold-frame spectacles, each lens scarcely bigger around than a quarter, and announced in broken English that he was hungry. He had lost two regiments, pinched off in the chase as had been feared. Otherwise, he was whole and hearty, eager for more fighting. Just now, though, he was hungry. Curtis hardly knew what to make of such a man, but he fed him and took him out for an inspection of the lines. Siegel's two divisions were on the right, the other two having sidestepped to make room for them on the two-mile-long shelf of land overlooking the hollow of Sugar Creek. A mile to their rear was the hamlet of Leetown, a dozen cabins clustered around a store and blacksmith shop, which in turn lay about halfway between the line of battle and the sudden rise of Pea Ridge, rearing abruptly against the northern sky like a backdrop for a theatrical production. Outcropped with granite and feathered with trees along its crest, the ridge extended eastward for 2 miles, then gave down upon a narrow north-south valley. Through this defile ran the Springfield-Fayetteville Road, known locally as the Wire Road because the telegraph had its southern terminus here in a two-story frame building where the telegrapher lived and took in lodgers overnight. Elkhorn Tavern, it was called, acquiring its name from the giant skull and antlers nailed to the roof tree. The tavern lay to the left rear of the position Curtis had chosen, and the road led down past it, through the entrenchments his troops had been digging all that day, and on across the creek to where the rebel army, filing in, was settling down and kindling campfires in the dusk. They had brought their weather with them. It was snowing, and their fires twinkled in the gathering moonless darkness, more and more of them as more soldiers filed in from the south to extend the line. Down to 10,500 as a result of Siegel's losses, the Federals were outnumbered, and they knew it. Watching the long, strung-out necklace of enemy campfires growing longer every hour. Still, they felt reasonably secure behind their new-turned mounds of dirt and logs, white-blanketed under the sift of snow falling softly out of the darkness. They built their own fires higher against the cold, then bedded down for a good night's sleep before the dawn, which they believed would light the way for an all-out Confederate lunge across the creek and against their works. March 7th came in bleak and gray, overcast but somewhat warmer. The snow had stopped, the wind had fallen in the night. As Curtis's men turned out of their bedrolls, peering south through the fog that rose out of the hollow, they saw something they had not expected to see. The plain was empty over there. Last night's rebel campfires were cold ashes, and the men who had kindled and fed them were nowhere in sight. In the past 3 days, the Confederates had marched better than 50 miles, the wind driving wet snow in their faces all the way. Their rations were gone, consumed on the march, and they were tired and hungry. There had to be a battle now, if only for the sake of capturing enemy supplies. However, Van Dorn had no intention of sending his weary men against breastworks prepared for their reception. Impetuous though he was, that was not his way. Conferring with his generals, who knew the country well, he decided to send half his troops on a night march, clean around the north side of Pea Ridge, then down the road past Elkhorn Tavern for a dawn attack on the Union left rear. Once this was launched, the other half of his army, having made a coincidental shorter march to the west end of the ridge, would come down through Leetown to strike the enemy right rear, which by then should be in motion to support the hard-pressed left. In short, it was to be a double envelopment, much like the one Nathaniel Lyon had attempted at Wilson's Creek, except that this time the attackers would outnumber the defenders, 17,000 men with 60 guns, opposing 10,500 with 50. Price's Missourians drew the longer march beyond the screening ridge. McCulloch and Pike, with their Texans, Arkansans, Louisianians, and Indians, would make the secondary attack. Van Dorn himself, still in his ambulance, the three-day ride through wind and snow had not reduced his fever, would go with the roundabout column to be on hand for the charge that would open the conflict. Soon after dark, the army filed off to the left, leaving its long line of campfires burning to deceive the Federals, and moved northward in column beyond the enemy right flank. In this hare and tortoise contest, the youthful, impetuous cavalryman Earl Van Dorn against the aging, methodical engineer Sam Curtis, the hare was off and running. Puzzled by the disappearance of the rebels from across the creek next morning, Curtis was in the worse-than-tortoise position of not even knowing that a race was being run, let alone that the goal was his own rear. Through the early morning hours, while the sun climbed higher up the sky to melt away the fog and fallen snow, he was left wondering where and why Van Dorn had gone. Then, suddenly, he knew. Just as they had confirmed his fears about the 40-gun salute he had heard on Monday, so now on Friday his scouts came riding in to solve the mystery of the rebels' disappearance. They were behind Pea Ridge, about to enter the north-south valley that gave down upon his unprotected rear. They had been delayed by obstructions along the road, the scouts reported, but they were coming fast now and in strength. Curtis would have to do one of two things. He could wheel about and meet them here, fighting with his back to his own entrenchments, or he could try to make a run for it. In the latter case, the choice lay between possible and probable destruction. If he tried to get away northward up the wire road through the defile, the Confederate spearhead would be plunged into the flank of his moving column. If, on the other hand, he ran southward through enemy country, retreating forward, so to speak, Van Dorn would be across his lines of supply and communication. The rebels would have him bottled in a wintry vacuum. He chose to meet them. His four divisions were in line, facing south. Siegel's two on the right, led by Peter Osterhaus and Alexander Aspath, the former a German, the latter a Hungarian. Then his own two under Eugene Carr, a vigorous, hard-mannered regular, and an Indiana-born colonel with the improbable name of Jefferson Davis. Curtis ordered them to about-face, the rear thus becoming the front, the left the right the left. Carr was sent at once to meet the threat beyond Elkhorn Tavern. Osterhaus moved up past Lee Town to protect the western flank, and presently on second thought Curtis sent Davis to support him, while Aspath remained under Siegel, in reserve. Curtis had confidence in his commanders. Colonels Osterhaus, Carr, and Davis had had considerable combat experience, the first two at Wilson's Creek and the third from as far back as Fort Sumter, where he had been an artillery lieutenant. Aspath, a brigadier, had been Fremont's chief of staff and a fighter under Kossuth back in Europe. How far beyond the claims of past performance they deserved their leader's confidence was about to be determined, and this was especially true of Carr, who stood where the first blow was about to fall. At 10:30 it fell, and it fell hard. Tired and hungry after their stumbling all-night march, but keyed up by the order to charge at last, Price's men came crashing through the brush along both sides of the wire road, guns barking aggressively on the flanks and from the rear. Carr had prepared a defense in depth. Batteries staggered along the road and a strong line of infantry posted to support the foremost while the other three fired over their heads. Presently, though, they had nothing to support. A well-directed salvo knocked out three of the four guns and blew up two caissons, killing all the cannoneers. Unnerved, the infantry fell back on the second battery just north of the tavern, where they managed to repulse the first attack, then the second, both of which were piecemeal. Bearded like a Cossack, Carr rode among his soldiers, shouting encouragement. Out front, the brush was boiling with butternut veterans forming for a third assault. This one would come in strength, he knew, and he doubted if his thin line could resist it. He sent a courier galloping back to Curtis with an urgent request for reinforcements. Curtis had his headquarters on a little knoll just south of a farm road leading from Elkhorn Tavern to Lee Town. Here the courier found him surrounded by his staff, mounted and resplendent, wearing their best clothes for battle. They were looking toward the left front, their attention drawn by a sudden rattle of musketry and a caterwaul of unearthly high-pitched yelling. Carr's message had scarcely been delivered when a horseman came riding fast from that direction. Osterhaus had been swamped by a horde of befeathered, screaming men who bore down on him brandishing scalping knives and hatchets. Taken aback, they had bargained for nothing in all the world like this. His troops had broken, abandoning guns and equipment. Davis had moved up. He was holding as best he could, but he needed reinforcements. Appealed to thus by the commanders of both wings at once, Curtis chose to wait before committing his reserve. He sent word for both to hold with what they had. At this point, the battle racket swelled to new and separate climaxes, right and left. In contrast to the gloom that had descended on him, first as a result of his failure to gobble up the scattered Federal units on the march, and then because of the delay of his flanking column as it moved around Pea Ridge in the night, which had thrown him 3 hours behind schedule and cost him the rich fruits of full surprise, Van Dorn was exultant. Price's men were surging ahead, knocking back whatever stood in their way, and off to the west the rolling crackle of McCulloch's attack told him of success in that quarter as well. The fighting still raged furiously at the near end of the ridge. Carr's second line was thrown back by the all-out third assault, so that presently the Missourians were whooping around the tavern itself and drinking from the horse trough in the yard. All this took time, however. As the sun slid down the sky, Van Dorn's exultation began to be tempered by concern. His men had had no sleep all night and nothing to eat since the day before, whereas the Federals had had a good night's rest and a hot breakfast. The Confederates still fought grimly, battering now at Carr's third line, drawn south and west of the tavern, but weariness and hunger were sapping their strength. Much of the steam had gone out of their attacks. Worse still, there was no longer any sound of serious fighting on the far side of the field, where McCulloch's earlier gains had been announced by the clatter moving south and east to mark his progress. Van Dorn was left wondering until near sundown, when a messenger arrived to explain the silence across the way. There, as here, the battle had opened on a note of victory. Pike's Indians, delighted at having frightened Osterhaus into hurried retreat, pranced around the cannon the white men had abandoned. Wagon guns, they called them, and took the horse collars from the slaughtered animals to wear about their own necks. "Me big Injun, big as horse," they chanted, dancing so that the trace chains jingled against the frozen ground. It was a different matter, though, when Pike tried to get them back into line to help McCulloch, who had run into stiffer resistance on the left. They had had enough of that. They wanted to fight from behind rocks or up in trees, not lined up like tenpins, white man style, to be struck by the iron bowling balls the wagon guns threw with a terrifying boom and a sudden choking cloud of smoke. Some stood firm, a dismounted cavalry battalion of mixed-bloods, for example, under Colonel Stand Waity, a Georgia-born Cherokee. But in the main, whatever was to be accomplished from now on would have to be done without the help of anything more than a scattering of red men. Not that McCulloch particularly minded. He was not given to calling on others for help, either back in his Texas Ranger days or now. When his advance was held up by an Illinois outfit which had rallied behind a snake-rail fence at the far end of a field, he brought up an Arkansas regiment, shook out a skirmish line, and took them forward, sunlight glinting on the sharpshooter's rifle he carried for emergencies and sport. The Illinois troops delivered a volley that sent the butternuts scampering back across the field. They reformed and charged again. 60 yards short of the tree-lined fence, they came upon a body in sky-blue trousers and a dove-gray corduroy jacket, sprawled in the grass. McCulloch. His rifle was gone, along with a gold pocket watch he had prized, but he still wore the expensive boots he had died in when the bullet found his heart. Quickly, then, word spread among the men who had sworn that they would storm hell itself at his command. McCulloch's dead. They killed McCulloch. Their reaction to the news was much the same in effect as the Indians' reaction to artillery. Whatever they had sworn they would do with McCulloch to lead them, it soon became clear that they would do little without him. To complete the confusion, his successor was killed within the hour, and the third commander was captured while attempting to rally some soldiers who, as it turned out, were Federals. By the time Pike was found and notified, he had been trying vainly all the while to reorganize his frightened or jubilant Indians. The sun was near the landline, and there were considerably fewer troops for him to head. Dazed with grief for their lost leader, many had simply wandered off the field, following him in death as they had in life. Osterhaus and Davis, having themselves had enough fighting for one day, had been content to watch them go unmolested. At sundown, Pike assembled what men he could find and set out on a march around the north side of Pea Ridge to join Van Dorn and Price, whose battle still raged near Elkhorn Tavern. News of his right wing's disintegration reached Van Dorn as one more in a series of disappointments and vexations. Repeated checks and delays here on the left, where Price's men were being held up by less than half their number, had brought him to the verge of desperation. There was another problem, no less grave and quite as vexing. Having left his wagon train on the far side of the battleground, the diminutive commander had discovered an unwelcome military axiom, namely that when you gain the enemy's rear, you also place him in your own, unless you bring it with you. Consequently, in addition to a numbing lack of sleep and food, just as he was doing all he could to launch a final charge that would crush Carr at last and sweep the field before nightfall ended the fighting and gave the Federals a chance to realign their now superior forces, his men were experiencing an ammunition shortage. Desperately, he ordered them forward, putting all he had into what he knew would use up the last of daylight as well as the last of their strength and ammunition. Price was there to help him. Nicked by a bullet but refusing to retire for medical treatment, he wore his wounded arm in a sling as he rode from point to point to bolster his men's spirits for an all-out climax to the night-long march and day-long battle. At last, between the two of them, they got the Missourians into assault formation and sent them forward, streaming around the tavern and down both sides of the wire road across which Carr had drawn his third stubborn line of resistance. The red ball of the sun had come to rest on the horizon. Carr's men could see it over their left shoulders, the direction in which they had been watching all these hours for reinforcements that did not come. Now, as before, their batteries were distributed in depth along the road, and now as then the Confederates wrecked them gun by gun with a preliminary bombardment. After an ominous lull, they saw the rebels coming, yelling and firing as they came, hundreds of them bearing down to complete the wreckage their artillery had begun. As the Federals fell back from their shattered pieces, an Iowa cannoneer paused to toss a smoldering quilt across a caisson, then ran hard to catch up with his friends. Still running, he heard a tremendous explosion and looked back in time to see a column of fire and smoke standing tall above the place where he had fused the vanished caisson. Stark against the twilight sky, it silhouetted the lazy-seeming rise and fall of blown-off arms and legs and heads and mangled trunks of men who just now had been whooping victoriously around the captured battery position. Over on his headquarters knoll, Curtis heard and saw it too, and finally, as if that violent column of smoke and flame standing lurid against the twilight on the right, followed after an interval by the boom and rumble as the sound of the explosion echoed off the ridge to the north, had at last brought home to him, like the ultimate shout of despair from a drowning man, at least some measure of the desperation Carr had been trying to communicate ever since Price first struck him 8 hours back, responded. By then, the sporadic firing on the left had died away. Osterhaus and Davis reported the rebels gone or going. Van Dorn was tricky, but Curtis felt the danger from that direction had been removed. He could look to the right, where by now the column of fire had turned into a mushrooming pillar of smoke. Asboth, who had remained all this time in reserve to meet the disaster in either direction, was sent up the wire road in relief of Carr. Arriving at 7, he found the firing reduced to a sputter here as well. Torn and weary, Carr's regiments moved back from their fourth position of the day, retiring through the ranks of the division that relieved them. Forward of there, extending right and left of the tavern, half a mile each way, the Confederates were bedding down for the rest they sorely needed, their campfires in the tavern yard illuminating the building up to the bleached skull and antlers on the roof tree. The long day's fight was over. Curtis rode out for a night inspection of his lines, which at some points were so near the enemy's that the opposing soldiers could overhear each other's groans and laughter. Despite their bone-deep weariness, the men were still too keyed up for sleep. They amused themselves by taunting the Rebs across the way, hooting at the replies provoked, and recounting, for mutual admiration, exploits they had performed on the field today. Several could even substantiate their claims. One, for example, an Illinois private, Peter Pelican by name, displayed a gold watch he had taken as a trophy off a rebel he had shot. An officer, he said, in sky-blue breeches and a dove-colored jacket. Some other quick-thinking scavenger had got the Maynard rifle, much to Pelican's regret, and the Johnnies had come swarming back too soon for him to have time to strip the dead man of his fancy boots. The Federal commander might have heard this as he made the rounds, along with much else like it, but the truth was he took little pleasure in small talk, and especially not now. He had too much on his mind. For one thing, he was irked at Siegel, who he considered had undertaken considerably less than his share of the work today, sparing Osterhaus and Aspoth while Davis and Carr were doing most of the bleeding. Consequently, when he discovered that the German planned a temporary withdrawal to feed his troops, his temper snapped. "Let Siegel's men hold their lines. Send supper out, not the men in," he said gruffly. And having thus relieved his spleen, he returned to his headquarters tent. It was time to decide what to do about tomorrow. Still fully dressed, he lay down on some blankets spread on a pile of straw, and sent for his division commanders to join him for a council of war. It was midnight when they assembled. Siegel spoke first, and he spoke from desperation, proposing his specialty, slashing retreat. The army, he said, must select an escape route and cut its way out in the morning. Osterhaus agreed, and so did Carr, whose command had been fought to a frazzle. He was nursing a wound, as was Aspoth, who had been winged by a stray bullet in the dark and also saw no answer but retreat. Davis was silent, but that was his manner, a gloomy man with a long nose and lonesome-looking eyes. Reclined on the blanketed pile of straw, Curtis weighed their counsel. No less deliberate in conference than he had been in combat, he was not going to be stampeded by his own commanders any more than he had been stampeded by Van Dorn. In his opinion, the Confederates had most likely shot their bolt. The threat to his left having been abolished, he could reinforce his right. Thus bolstered, the army could hold its own, he believed, and even perhaps go forward. On this note, the council adjourned, and its members, their advice declined, went out into the darkness to consolidate their commands and await the dawn. The night was cold and windless, so that when dawn came through at last, smoke from yesterday's battle still hung in long folds and tendrils about the fields, draping the hillsides and filling the hollows level full. The sun rose red, then shone wanly through the haze, like tarnished brass. Van Dorn's dispositions were at once apparent across the way. South and west of Elkhorn Tavern, between the Federals and the Sunrise, Price's Missourians held the ground they had won when nightfall closed the fighting. Pike having arrived in the night with his and McCulloch's remnants, the Confederate commander had stationed the Indians along the crest of Pea Ridge, supporting several batteries. Stark up there against the sky, they looked like stick men guarding toy guns, while the Texans and Arkansans occupied the fields along its base. It was a long, concave line, obviously drawn with defense in mind. Curtis had been right. Also right, as it turned out, were the dispositions he had made to meet what dawn revealed. Davis was posted opposite the tavern, with Carr's division in support, still binding up its wounds. The left belonged to Siegel, who had strung out Osterhaus and Aspoth to overlap the enemy in the shadow of the ridge. After a drawn-out silence, during which the Unionists enjoyed a hot breakfast and the rebels ate what they could find in the knapsacks of the fallen, Van Dorn opened with his batteries, stirring the smoke that wreathed the Federal line. The cannonade was perfunctory and had no real aggressive drive behind it. Low as he was on ammunition, his unprotected train had gone off southward, fearing capture. Van Dorn fired his guns not as a prelude to attack, nor even to signify his readiness to receive one, but merely to see what the Yankees would do. In fact, that was why he had remained in position overnight. It had seemed wrong to retreat after the gains he had made, and for all he knew, the dawn might show the Federals gone or ready to surrender. Dawn had shown no such thing. It showed them rather in what seemed greater strength than ever, a long, compact line with batteries glinting dangerously through the coppery haze. Hungry, weary, down to their last rounds of ammunition, Van Dorn's men had done their worst, and he knew it. Yet for all he knew, after yesterday's hard knocks, Curtis, too, might be reduced to his last ounce of powder and resistance, needing no more than a prod to send him scampering. At any rate, the Mississippian thought it worth a try. It soon became apparent that the Federals could take a good deal more prodding than the Southerners could exert. Sensing the weakness behind the cannonade, Curtis sent word to Siegel on the left. Yesterday the German had held back. Now let him seize the initiative and go forward if he could. Siegel could and did. With a precision befitting a mathematician, he ordered his infantry to lie down in the muddy fields while he advanced his batteries 250 yards out front and opened fire. He rode among the roaring guns, erect as on parade, except when he dismounted to sight an occasional piece himself, then patted the breech and stepped back, as if for applause, to observe the effects of his gunnery. It was accurate. Battery after Confederate battery was shattered along the ridge and on the flat, and when others came up to take their places, they were shattered too. Siegel's soldiers, many of them German like himself, cheered him wildly as they watched the rebel cannoneers fan backward from the wreckage of their guns. Over on the right, the men of Carr and Davis, watching too, began to understand the pride that lay behind the boast, "I fight Smith Siegel." Van Dorn's artillerymen were not the only ones disconcerted by the deadliness of the Yankee gunnery. His infantry showed signs of wavering, too. Siegel rode back to where his cheering soldiers lay obedient in the mud. Gesturing with his saber, he ordered them to stand up and go forward. They did so, still cheering, in a long undulating line, like a huge snake moving sideways, the head coiling over the lower slope of the ridge, the center thrusting forward with a lunging sidewinder motion, the tail following in turn. On it moved with a series of curious sidewise thrusts, preceded by a scattering of graybacks as it slithered over whatever stood in its broad path. The reserve Union regiments waiting in ranks tossed their hats and contorted their faces with screams of pride and pleasure at the sight. Exhilarated, Siegel stood in his stirrups, saber lifted, eyes aglow. "Oh, dat was lovely!" he exclaimed. Over near the tavern, watching the great snake glide sideways up the ridge, the men with Davis began shouting for a charge on this front too, lest Siegel's troops get all the loot and glory. Curtis was with them. Indeed, he was everywhere this morning. Already two of his orderlies had been killed riding with him as he galloped amid shell bursts to inspect his line and strengthen weak spots. All the same, active as he was, he had not put aside his meticulous insistence on precision. Sending for reinforcements, he remained to check their prompt arrival by the second hand on his watch, then was off again through the smoke and whistling fragments of exploding shells. When the men in front of the tavern began yelling for a chance to match the tableau Siegel was staging on the left, Curtis nodded quick assent and rode forward onto a low knoll. He had a fondness for such little elevations in battle or bivouac, to watch as they advanced. Close-ranked and determined, they surged past him, cheering. Abruptly, then, beyond their charging front, he saw the Confederates give way, retreating before contact, and heard his soldiers whooping as they swarmed around and past Elkhorn Tavern, where the telegrapher's family huddled in the cellar and rebel dead were stacked like cordwood on the porch. The Union right and left wings came together with a shout, driving the gray confusion of scampering men, careening guns, and wild-eyed horses pell-mell up the wire road through the defile, past the position Carsmen had abandoned under pressure from the opening guns 24 hours back. As quickly as that, almost too sudden for realization, the battle was over. One. Curtis rode down off the knoll, then cantered back and forth along his lines. His aging engineer's brown eyes were shining. All his former stiff restraint was gone. Boyishly, he swung his hat and shouted, performing a little horseback dance of triumph as he rode up and down the lines of cheering men. "Victory!" he cried. He kept swinging his hat and shouting. "Victory! Victory!" he cried. Thus Curtis, but Van Dorn was somewhat in the predicament of having prodded a shot bare, thinking it dead, only to have the creature rear up and come charging at him, snarling. Consequently, his main and, in fact, his exclusive concern in the face of this sudden show of teeth and claws was how to get away unmangled. Horrendous as it was, however, the problem was not with him long. His soldiers solved it for him. Emerging from the north end of the defile, they scattered in every direction except due south, where the prodded bear still roared. All through what was left of the day and into the night,